Please be advised this podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence and it's not appropriate for children.
But what really did my head in on this particular search was crime scene actually found a tooth, and they found it in between the skirting board and the carpet.
This is Australian True Crime. Come with us as we explore how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Melissa Trailovich and Tony Serrano, aged 61 and 63 respectively, had what some of us might consider an unorthodox relationship, but they both lived turbulent lives, starting with difficult childhoods on the other side of the world. The end of their lives would be no easier. Neither Melissa nor Tony had any other family in Australia, but around Christmas 2004, Melissa's sister back in Serbia became alarmed when she was unable to get in touch with her. She reported Melissa missing and the case landed on the desk of Narelle Fraser.
I was a detective with missing persons, and this was one of those ones where the flags come up and you think, oh no, there's something going on here. So Melissa lived in Endeavour Hills. She'd been living with Tony for about 8 years. And
how old was she, sorry?
She was 61.
Right.
And Tony was 63.
Okay.
And Melissa was born in Yugoslavia. She'd been in Australia for years. She'd been married over here and her first husband had died. Tony Serrano, I can't call him Tony, it's a bit too personal. He was born in Spain and he was a little bit sad, I suppose. He was from an orphanage. So he came out here with, you know, no parents, and he came to Australia in 72. But him and Melissa lived in Endeavour Hills. They were together about 8 years and they didn't have any kids. And it was a really strange arrangement because he had his own unit in Hallam and she lived in Endeavour Hills, but he used to go and stay over there, I don't know, a couple of nights a week. And, yeah, it was just a little bit different, I suppose.
And those suburbs are pretty close by, aren't they? They're in the southeast of Melbourne.
Yeah, they're not very far. Like maybe, I don't know, he might have lived 5 k's away, something like that.
Okay. So they never moved in together? Not completely?
Not completely, no. So she had family overseas. She had a sister and some nieces and nephews that she was very close to, but nobody over here, as he had nobody either. So they really only had each other, really. And they were, you know, part of the Serbian or Yugoslavian, I don't know, a community group at Hallam and in Endeavour Hills. So they had a reasonably, you know, good social life. We believe that the only thing they used to argue about was money. But as the podcast goes on, it becomes quite obvious that Tony was besotted with money. It was his main aim in life was to have money.
Well, I suppose that he wouldn't be the first person to come from such humble beginnings who would then be very, very focused on money.
Obviously. And I'm not saying you can make excuses for him, but you understand that he didn't have an easy life. But not all people that don't have parents end up killing their girlfriend or their partner. So when we became involved, the last time that Melissa was seen, she was quite a big woman, like a typical big German woman, you know, quite not obese, but just big.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she had really big, it'll be obvious why I'm saying this, but she had big feet. She had big clothes that were sort of like big women's clothes, you know, like almost like a tent sort of, you know, to cover herself. I get that. Mm-hmm. And so Tony was the complete opposite. He was little, short. He wasn't a big man. They were a very odd couple. So we got the job in March.
Who reported her missing?
Her sister in Serbia.
Wow.
Yes. The last time she was seen, Melissa was an avid gardener and she was always outside at her house gardening. The last time she was seen was Boxing Day 03. And for about a month, nobody sort of really knew anything.
So people used to see her in the garden.
Yep.
Neighbours, passers-by.
They were supposed to go, her and Tony were supposed to go to a New Year's Eve function that Melissa had bought tickets for. They were also going to a Serbian community, something or other, around Christmas time, and they didn't go. But it was Melissa's sister over in Serbia that was the one that reported her missing because she just couldn't get onto her. And Tony, when she rang, Tony had answered the phone at Melissa's house. And, you know, he'd say that she'd met someone else. This comes up a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, doesn't it?
That they've had an affair or they've found someone else. And that's what Tony said, but Melissa's sister knew there was something wrong anyway. Eventually she reported them missing, her missing, and the local Dandenong CIB initially did the initial investigations. And remember me telling you that on our LEAP system, our law enforcement system, every reported missing person in Victoria is put on our system, and there's some that just, you know, that gut feeling and they have those little ticks, you sort of think it's really strange. Mm. So we were monitoring this for, I don't know, maybe a month, and things weren't getting any better, so we decided to take it over because it just started to, what I say, it started to smell. Mm-hmm. There was something really strange about it. Anyway, so off we go. We go out to
Can I just ask a question?
Yes.
Is it because, and it's starting to feel that way through working on this podcast, that when a woman is missing and her male partner or ex-partner isn't, that it feels like he may have harmed her? Like, is that a pretty immediate question in your mind that you have to solve?
Not that he may have, but he's certainly a person of interest.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, even when she's just missing, even when we don't know that anyone's been murdered, it feels like when a woman comes up missing in your system and there's also a bit of, and I called her home and her partner answered and he said this stuff, is that's a flag?
It is a bit, yeah. Although there are missing people where they genuinely go missing and the husband or the partner has just no idea. They've been, you know, like your Jill Maher where they're...
I was thinking of Jill Maher.
Yeah, where they've just been taken off the street or...
Yeah. But that's rare by comparison, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is a bit of a flag. But you've, as I've said to you before, remember that the parachute theory where you've really got to keep your mind open, and even though... you might think, oh, he's a nice bloke. Yes, she may have had an affair, maybe. But you've also always in the back of your mind, you've got to think it actually could be him. You wouldn't be doing your job properly if you didn't look everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, at kids, at friends, at neighbours. You've got to keep your mind open to that sort of thing.
Yeah, even if he's an asshole, it doesn't mean that you've got to close your mind off to the idea that he hasn't done anything to her.
Absolutely.
That would be harder for me, I think, to keep my mind open.
It's hard.
Yeah.
And you know that you might think he's an asshole, for instance, but you know you're thinking that.
Yeah.
And you've just got to put that aside because there's lots of awful people out there that don't murder.
Yeah.
Or you know, or just seem to get along with life with being awful people. But Tony... he was very assertive, very arrogant, and it was easy to not like him. He was very argumentative, and he thought we were, you know, making a mountain out of a molehill. He just couldn't understand why we were talking to him and why we would actually want to speak to him. I mean, initially, he was just what we call a person of interest. Mm. He's not a suspect. He's just somebody we need to speak to him to find out about Melissa because he was the closest one to her. But he was very, he was just arrogant. Yeah, he rubbed us up the wrong way from the get-go. However, doesn't mean that he murdered her.
Okay.
Do you find when you're interviewing people and when you're meeting them for the first time, because I feel like sometimes you just get that vibe where it's an uncomfortable vibe from someone, you know, and you've said to us before that you do trust it, but you've got to keep it open-minded. But do you find that that instinct's usually correct?
Yes.
Yeah, because I feel that. You know, when you meet someone, you're just like, I don't get good vibes off you.
I don't think any of us got good vibes from the minute we met Tony. But, and, you know, the Dandenong detectives as well, he was the same with them. It was just his persona. And it wasn't a particularly likeable one. I would think generally our gut feelings are pretty good. The Dandenong CIB, they've been looking at, you know, doing the standard stuff, the door knocks and all that sort of thing, but they don't really come up with anything. There's nothing to say something has happened, but there's nothing to say it hasn't. And we've been monitoring it on the LEAP system anyway. We just decide, no, you know, we make a decision. The bosses say, no, we're going out there. So virtually the day we decide to take it over, we go out there and we have a team. We have a detective senior sergeant, a detective sergeant, and generally, say, three or four detectives. And the sergeant is really the one on the ground that makes the decisions. But if there's something a bit more important to discuss, he will generally keep in contact, at least telephone contact, with the detective senior sergeant, who's often in the office. But he will sometimes come out as well if it warrants it, if he just wants to get a bit of a feel for the job. Anyway, so we have two members. The Dandenong detectives have done a door knock, but we decide we don't know what they've asked. We haven't been there, so we want to do it again. So we do the door knock. So we have two members do the door knock and associated inquiries with the door knock. We have a couple of members that try and get that rapport going with Tony, and that happened. I don't remember who the members were, but it went, you know, reasonably well. And remember me telling you that we need to get a statement from Tony before he is a suspect, because once he is a suspect, we have to treat him differently. Section 464 of the Crimes Act, and it's fair enough too, is that once you are a suspect, you then have to be given your rights, you have to be cautioned, all that sort of stuff. So it's very, very important to get a statement from Tony before he becomes a suspect.
It's interesting. I didn't realise there was actually a formal moment where you become a suspect either. Like, it feels like it's just a kind of an organic thing where the police suddenly start to suspect you of being involved. But there's actually a moment where you say to each other, okay, he is now a suspect and thus
pretty
has
much,
to be treated
yes.
differently.
Yeah, like you can have in the back of your mind.
Yeah.
But a court will often argue, when was it that you, when he became a suspect in your mind?
Mm.
So you've got to be very clear about when he is a person of interest and when he actually crosses that line into being a suspect.
Yeah.
Really, in the end, it's about fairness too. Mm. You can't go interviewing somebody that actually you think has done it and trying to get around the back door so that you don't have to caution him and he knows that he can have a solicitor and all that. That's very unfair. And really, most likely you would lose that at court because they would, again, they'd question you.
Yeah.
When did he become a suspect in your mind? Well, the minute I found, I don't know, say blood on the couch.
Or a tooth in the
moulding.
Yeah. So, yeah. But that said, you know, you have a thorough conversation with him when you first meet him.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just to make sure that he doesn't sort of initially say, oh, I've done it.
Yeah.
But that was never, ever going to happen with Tony. Anyway, so we have two members speak to him. They get a statement from him, history of the relationship, all that sort of stuff. He told us there was a couple of, he'd first of all told us that she'd met someone else. Then he tells us, what happened is on Boxing Day I dropped her at the bus stop at Dandenong, outside the Dandenong Plaza. Oh, didn't you say that she'd met someone else? Oh, well, yes, I might have said that, but I'd forgot to tell you, you know, so they sort of backtrack. Anyway, he stuck with that from that moment on, that she'd booked tickets to a Jehovah's Witness conference in Queensland, that she'd booked bus tickets and that he took her down to the plaza and she said, I don't want you to drop me out right out the front, which probably for the cameras, I don't know. I would assume that's why he did that. But he left her there at 8:35 and came home. That's the last he saw of her. And that was on Boxing Day of 2003. So that's what he was saying was the last time that he saw her.
Wouldn't that be fairly easy to chase up with the bus companies and...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it was. And, of course, that's what we do. Everything that he tells us, we're trying to either implicate him or exculpate him. We are just following what he's told us. We're just really trying to find the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So the bus company, they couldn't say that she did get on, but they couldn't say she didn't either. They were very, and we couldn't find a ticket in her name, nothing like that, nothing to support what he's saying. The Jehovah's Witness conference up in Queensland, there was something like 2,000 people, but we never established that she went. But, of course, that takes a long time.
Mm.
Like, it's not just a phone call. You know, and I understand why, but people are very hesitant to give you private information, like about did somebody attend or not. They don't.
Was Melissa a Jehovah's Witness or was this just a random thing that
I think she was a Jehovah's Witness, yeah. So we also have two members that are preparing a search warrant at Tony's house because we're trying to find evidence of a crime. So because it's her house, we have to try and find, you know, whether she's packed a suitcase, whether clothes are missing, but also we might find evidence of a disturbance. So we have two members preparing that. And we also had a couple of members doing your standard Medicare, the bus company, the Jehovah's Witness, the phones. There was a couple of things there. The phone, she'd made a couple of calls to a carpet layer and we were never able to locate him. It was a company. And of course, thinking about what Tony had said about she'd met someone else, you couldn't just say, oh, well, look, you've said this story, now you're saying that story. You have to actually prove that the story about the affair is wrong. So what we've done is, because there is an unexplained male on the phone that she has called, we have to discount that. Yeah. So it's not just, you know, ringing the Jehovah's Witness, for instance, and them saying, oh, no, she didn't come. We have to have evidence, proof.
Mm.
So all these things take a lot of time. The door knock that we did, that gave us some further inquiries. The door knock, we found that they used to argue quite a bit. It was quite loud. But on Christmas Eve, I think, or Christmas Day, there was a huge argument that the neighbours next door heard, which was very unusual. As I said, they didn't go to the dance the Friday night that they were supposed to. We also found out with the door knock and a whole lot of other inquiries that Tony had been to the doctor on Boxing Day for a broken finger.
Oh.
See, you too? Mm. I can tell now. You've got him in those. Remember that parachute theory, girls?
Yeah, I know.
Mine's closing.
Yeah, yeah, my mind closes pretty quick, I must admit. But okay, Mr. Broken finger.
So he goes to the doctor with a broken finger. Now, we would all say, aha, of course, and we did like you.
Yeah.
But the doctor, we go to the doctor and the doctor says, oh, he got it caught in a door, because that's what Tony had told him.
Yeah.
We also find that Serrano, very, very soon after her last sighting, he'd been going around to the lady that had signed Melissa's will as a witness. He was going around to her asking who was getting the money, who was going to be the beneficiary of her money. He also went to a lawyer to try and find out where the money was going and how he could turn it around so that he got the money, not the niece. Like, that's what I mean about he was just, money was just everything to him.
Mm. Doesn't sound too smart either, because if he's saying she's just left, but 2 days after she's gone missing, he's asking about money, that to me is quite stupid.
Mm. Yeah.
Like that's not a...
And a friend of hers. He's asking a friend of hers who's been the witness
and
to
again,
her will.
And again, it's another tick, isn't it, where you think, so we've got the broken finger, we've got the argument, we've got two stories about, well, she's had an affair, and so it's all starting to come together. The neighbours hadn't seen her since Christmas Eve. She hadn't been out gardening and he didn't report her as missing.
No, he didn't.
No, and he certainly didn't have a reasonable explanation. So we do the 465 evidence warrant, which was approved. So we go to the house to do the warrant. Now, when we attend the house, we find, like, this is before we've done the warrant, right? You go into the house. I mean, you've got to talk to Tony and just have a bit of a look around. But this, a couple of days later, we do a proper search warrant to be able to take things legally. Like, you wouldn't take things on that first. It's just an inquiry, really, the first day.
So is he a suspect yet, formally?
Not at this stage.
Okay.
No,
so you
no.
can do all of that stuff without naming someone a formal suspect.
Oh, yeah.
You can get a warrant and all that.
Yeah, I mean, there's some concerns, but a suspect for a murder is a lot different than just a bit of a concern, you know, there's something not quite adding up here.
And I guess it was it her house that you were getting a warrant to look at?
Yes.
Right, so it's not even his house.
No. No, so we take in forensics, the crime scene people. They found blood splatterings everywhere that you could not have seen. So now...
Oh, God.
He is a suspect.
Yeah, okay. Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
Because we've got blood splatterings on the walls, which can only be found by luminol. And so what's happened is you can actually see the smear marks where he's tried to clean it up. Or, well, sorry, where somebody has tried to, but we're assuming it's him. So there's blood splatterings on the couch where we've been sitting, mind you. Yeah, I know. There's evidence that the lounge room walls have been cleaned. The cushions, there is one cushion missing from the lounge suite.
Mm.
There's a chair missing from a six-chair dining room setting. There's a chair missing. At the back of the house, we find a chair leg with something on it that we think is blood. Anyway, it was confirmed, yes, later it was, and it was her blood. We also find at the back of the house a pair of smashed reading glasses.
Mm.
Now, we thought they were probably Melissa's, but we weren't 100% sure because we didn't have anyone they didn't do a lot. They didn't have a lot of friends. Mm. We actually found out later that they were hers, but you see them at the back and things are starting to add up for Tony.
Yeah.
And if she's left, as he said, you take stuff like your reading glasses and your...
However, but we couldn't prove they were hers. Mm. And they were that type of reading glass where they could have been men's, they could have been women's. They weren't actually a lady's reading glass. Mm. So, but it was just something else to add to it.
And with the blood splatter patterns, do you get a sense of how much blood has been lost and then start to say someone likely did not survive this attack and stuff
that's
like that?
That's not us that say that. That's the crime scene people can. Yeah. They could actually say they believed that, I think it was something like she'd been beaten standing up, crouching and something else. So they could actually tell from the blood splatters where she had been, because they were able to prove that it was her blood. They could tell, like, it's amazing. They are incredible what they can do. But they could actually tell that, yeah, whether she'd been standing up, laying on one knee, sort of. It's incredible stuff. But the thing that really gave me the creeps with this, so when you start seeing the blood splatters, it actually makes, well, I don't know about anyone else, but it makes me feel actually sick to think that this poor woman has been beaten to the point where there's blood everywhere, and it was all over the couch and, of course, the cushion. You know, I told you about the missing cushion. We found that out the back. That had blood all over it. But what really did my head in on this particular search was crime scene actually found a tooth, and they found it in between the skirting board and the carpet to find a human tooth.
And it also suggests really vicious beating.
Yeah, brutal. Absolutely. Mm. Like, this isn't just a stab to the heart or a whack across the head. This is a vicious, uncontrollable rage almost. Mm. But that tooth, oh, my God. And to see it, because they showed us, oh, look what we've just found, surely. And they're saying, I think this is a tooth. And we all look and, oh, it was just, it made your heart sink. I thought, that poor woman. This is a lot of evidence.
Mm.
And what also we find is the carpet, a piece of carpet has been cut out and a rug has been put over it. Like, as you say, Emily, he's no brain surgeon.
No.
But, you know, for a month or so, he'd actually got away with it.
Yeah.
So this is what a 465 evidence warrant, it allows you to dig under the house if you wanted to. It's a very powerful warrant. So we had a lot of evidence. And another thing that really confused us, and I try and tell this to a lot of budding detectives or police in general, there was a pair of latex gloves. They were a skin colour and they were on the roof. Now, we couldn't work out. They could be Tony. Mm. They could have been the crook. You know, if it's not Tony, it could have been someone else. It could be the police that have been there before and had a bit of a look around, because the Dandenong police had been there helping the CIB. It could have been one of us, you know, that's thrown them up there after finishing, but we took a long time to establish whose gloves they were, and they're actually one of the police people and one of the initial police that had been there. And they felt really embarrassed that it had sort of sent the investigation off on a bit of a tangent, which didn't need to be. But I try and tell people that, yeah, look, it's not the best thing to do, but if you have done something like that, or the police will move something to get into a window, and when you go to examine the place, that something has been moved, and you say, has anyone moved? Because it might be in a strange place. And as you'll go, has anyone moved that? And everyone will say, no, I haven't. And you say, it doesn't matter if you have, but we do need to know because that means we have to get DNA, fingerprints, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, Tony's response to what we'd found, he was then interviewed for the disappearance of Melissa. Now, it's a difference, not the murder, but the disappearance.
Okay.
Where is she? Because we can't prove at this stage it's a murder. I mean, you'd have to put two and two together and most of us would get four.
Mm-hmm.
But from a legal point of view, you really... To have the body, you could say, you know, you're going to be interviewed for murder. But anyway, we interview him for the disappearance. And I remember at one stage, for some reason, we were at the Dandenong police station and I was sitting with Tony. I must have been involved. I wasn't the informant, but I must have been sitting with him maybe to try and get some rapport going or something, and he was just an angry little ant. I can get rapport, you know, with a piece of wood, generally.
Yes.
But Tony just, nothing. Anyway, I can remember thinking to myself, I think I'm in a room with a murderer that has beaten a woman senseless with a tooth in the in the floorboards, and I'm sitting here on my own with him. I mean, and that would, nobody meant to do that. It was just, I don't know, somebody's nicked out to get a piece of evidence or, you know, get something to bring in or a new tape or something. So, but I remember thinking that, my God.
Yeah, yeah. It must be an extraordinary feeling.
Well, it was a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because in an interview, you can't have a gun because obviously, you know, the dangers and all that sort of stuff. So anyway, I didn't have to use my powers of persuasion. So.
No. But also he was probably intimidated by you. It's like power and is a funny dynamic, isn't it? In this situation, this is your comfort zone. This is your place. You're surrounded by your people.
Yes.
And you're a police lady.
Yeah.
Whereas Melissa, who knows? I mean, what's gone on beforehand in their relationship to get to this point where he felt confident to beat her to that extent and that she couldn't fight back, even though she was physically so much larger than him.
Yes. Was just a rage, like to beat someone like that, you know.
And for a man who is suspected of doing that, it would probably be quite confronting for him to be in a room with a woman who's in a position of authority like you are.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
You know, you see that in cop shows sometimes. I purposely will put a woman in with a man who's,
you
know, who struggles with that dynamic. Mm.
Oh, he would have struggled big time. Mm. So he was interviewed, but he had answers, and I must have been in the interview because I can remember he had answers for everything. And you know that power thing you were talking about? It was very interesting because Tony was such a, he liked the power. Obviously he felt very powerful, but not in that situation with us, right? He actually, at one stage, I remember, he was asking the questions of us, like we're supposed to be in charge of the interview and managing the interview. But he would ask, why would you ask me that question? I told you. So he would put it back on us. So there was a real struggle of power in the interview. You just let him go because, number one, you've got to be seen as fair. But also sometimes I think he is just strangling himself.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have to. He was showing how angry. And that's what I thought was really good. In the interview, he showed how arrogant he was, how he would just try and manipulate everybody. And I thought, just hang yourself, mate. Just keep going because it's looking good because the jury will hear this. And you've got to be very careful. Again, there's that a line because you've got to give him an opportunity to give his side of the story. And if you don't give him that opportunity, it's seen as, you know, you're being unfair. Look, he's trying to tell you what he's doing and you're not allowing him. So there's a lot of lines, isn't there, with the whole thing, when he's a suspect, when he's a person of interest.
Yeah, but then we know that, you know, these are the ways that these cases can fall apart in court, that, you know, missing a moment like this, misjudging it, not hitting a formal mark like that can mean the whole thing falls apart later.
Another thing that he kept saying that in the interview that he had a hernia. And you'd think, well, what's that got to do with it? But he said that he couldn't lift her. He couldn't have done what he did, what we're alleging that he possibly did, because he had a hernia. So the hernia was his reason why he couldn't have murdered her. But strangely enough, the doctor, we went to a number of doctors that he had been to and he'd never mentioned a hernia. So this is another furphy that he's thrown into the mix.
It's a good one.
I really want to know.
No, it's an interesting idea to come up with, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'll tell them I've got a hernia.
Yeah, how could a little man like me pick up or attack this, I don't know if I'd call her huge, but she was a big woman.
Well, they're often women, I know myself, I'm a tall, bigger woman. You know, women in that part of the world are often quite strong.
And if he's particularly small physically.
And she was also, from what I've heard, she was also very strong mentally. Like Melissa wasn't just strong physically, she was a strong woman.
After the break, Tony makes a dramatic decision. Coming up on Australian True Crime, the investigation into the disappearance of Melissa Trailovich leads police to an isolated country road. But first, Narelle keeps working methodically through the case. I just have the tooth going round in my head.
I want to know
how Tony is going to explain the tooth. That's fascinating me.
Well, he never does.
Ah.
Okay, so we interview him for the disappearance. And he wasn't charged. He was left pending further inquiries. What do they say? Assisting police with their inquiries. Yes. But because we'd found blood in the house, we needed DNA from her family.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
To prove that it was her. Mm. So this was very difficult. So we wanted to go over to Serbia and take a proper sample to bring back, because the court would say, that's not good enough. The court would do that.
Yeah.
Anyway, we weren't given permission. So where do we go now?
Why weren't you given permission?
Probably because of the cost.
Yeah, I don't know.
They're the decisions the big wigs make, mm-hmm. not us. We refer to as the shit on the shoulders.
The number crunchers get all the shit on their shoulders,
they're the ones that make those big decisions. You know, all the badges on the shoulders. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So they're the ones that make those decisions. So what we then had to think of, how are we going to get that DNA? They didn't speak English. So what we did was we did a DNA kit and we got it translated into Serbian. Mm. So we then sent it over priority paid, or whatever you do, over to the police in Serbia. We got them to take the sample and then bring it back, obviously. Everything was registered in that, so you couldn't say it was contaminated.
Yeah, great.
But we used that, and I think the thinking was that if there was going to be an issue with it, they'd then get somebody. You know, if it came up, then they might get somebody to go over and take it. But we just needed to know that it was hers.
Yeah. And this was from the sister you got it?
Yep.
I'm interested, just going back a bit to the sister, who was the one who called this in, so mm-hmm. saying I haven't heard from her. Were they in quite close contact?
Oh, yeah, they were very, very close. As she said, the sister said, I've forgotten her name, I feel terrible not knowing her name, but she said that if she was having an affair or if she was unhappy with Tony, she would have said. I mean, she said that they, you know, had arguments about money and they had a few arguments, but generally Melissa was quite happy with Tony. But she didn't, apparently Melissa didn't stay at Tony's, because when she stayed over there at his place, he would ask for money for the electricity and the water. And
Wow. That's pretty
tight.
Isn't
that amazing?
Isn't it amazing?
And then she would, I think she thought, well, if he's going to do that at his place, I'm going to do that at my place. So he used to give her money towards the, you know, the electricity bills and all that, because she'd think, well, if he's going to do that with me, he's not staying here for free. So you see, isn't that amazing?
This is an 8-year relationship too.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, they've hung in there.
So yep.
Yeah. Yes. Other people's relationships are quite intriguing, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's not right or wrong, is it? It's just
different.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. So then we need to find out how we're, like, what are we going to do? Like, we don't know where she is. So we know she's been murdered. But where do you start looking for her, you know? So anyway, the neighbours said that they heard Tony leave on Boxing Day very early in the morning. And he didn't come back until very late at night. And apparently, for whatever reason, it was a little bit unusual. I think because they'd heard the argument the night before. And anyway, and it's funny, you know, I don't know if I've said before, but with door knocks, a lot of people won't actually ring the police. But when you go around there, they tell you amazing stuff. Mm. And it might be a bit to do with the questions you ask. Mm. I don't know. But a door knock gives invaluable information, a lot. We think, I wonder if he's taken her somewhere. And then we hear that he's been given a speeding fine up near Newborough, Mowey, Morwell Way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Okay.
So then we ring the police that pulled him over, because this is during the investigation time. He's been pulled over for speeding. So we ring the local cop and we say, tell us about this guy. So he said, oh, I can't tell you much other than, pardon me, he was a bit of a short ass. He had a bit of an attitude and he was very nervous. Now, you can't really take that in, because I even get nervous when the police pick me up. So, you know, for speeding or whatever. So you can't really take that into account. But then we thought, well, if he's – we couldn't work out. There was no reason for him to be in Mowey or Morwell. Like, he didn't have – actually, we found out that he did have met some woman, but she didn't live that way. She lived somewhere else. Tony didn't take long to find another love. But anyway, so...
Well, he's so attractive in so many ways.
Some women like that power, don't they?
Like paying for the power when they go and visit their boyfriends. Okay.
So we decide to get a tracking device. Anyway, it worked because we found that he had gone to this, off this bush track in Newborough, like for no reason. Well, we couldn't think of a reason. So we were able to pinpoint it. And it took a couple of days, but we had a huge search party. We probably had about, I don't know, 100 police, because we thought, what is he doing on a dirt track off the main highway in Newborough? It just, nothing made sense. So we had this huge search party and we ended up finding a pile of burnt clothing. It was her size, her type of matronly sort of clothing, her size shoe. So, but we never found anything else. But that was enough for him to be charged with murder.
Wow, okay.
So he was charged because we believed, obviously, that he'd murdered her. So we go to his unit in Hallam. We don't find much there. We weren't able to locate any DNA on the, because the clothes and the shoes had been burnt so badly, we could find no DNA. So we were never able to prove that was her clothing, ever. But when you put everything, you know, it's all those 1%ers that seem to add up. Anyway, he was formally interviewed. He denied any involvement. We were never able to find that carpet layer, never. He was charged with murder in 05.
So this took quite a while, this investigation, from New Year in 2004.
Yeah. So he was charged. He went to trial. On the last couple of days of the trial, he went missing. They couldn't find him. He skipped bail. They took, I don't know, what, 12 months, something like that, to find him, and they found him in Cairns. They sentenced him with him not being there because the trial, which is most unusual, but the trial had gone so far and they'd heard most of the witnesses' accounts. So they made a finding without him there. Anyway, he was found guilty of murder and sentenced to 17 years, but they couldn't find him. Anyway, he was eventually located in Cairns. He was extradited and he's now serving time at Her Majesty's prison.
And you've never found the remains of Melissa?
Never.
Is there a theory of where she might be or any inkling?
Well, no. I think it's probably around Mowi, Morwell, up that way. But I saw that he had a licence. Now, he used to be, he had an excavator's licence and something else, and I think, he's probably buried hers. I don't know. But I know that the crime scene people were able to say that basically she was murdered in the house, absolutely. Mm. Because of all the blood. And
was she beaten with the chair?
Yeah. So we've never found her.
That's so sad.
It's incredibly sad. And it's just amazing that we can still live in a, with all of our technology and with everything we have, that we can still not find remains sometimes.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. And I hate to say it, but, like, she's a big woman. So it's like,
she wouldn't be easy to hide.
No, for this little man to move her around in and out of a car. And all of that as well must have been incredibly difficult.
He could have, you know, done what Sharp did and hardly bears thinking about. But her sister and her family over in Serbia, apparently they gave victim impact statements to the court that were just, heart-wrenching. Well, of course they would be, but every victim impact statement is. It's just such a personal an opportunity to say how it's affected them, but he's never shown any remorse, never.
Has he ever admitted?
No.
Nothing.
And he never will. Just not the type of person.
I wonder if it's like, you know, when we spoke to Keith Moore about the disappearance of Donald Mackay and they were devout Catholics. Mm-hmm. I think Serbia is a Catholic. There's Catholic and Muslim, but, you know, there is that belief, you know, your loved one is not going to be at rest. If, you know, there's no body, it's all in limbo, you know what I mean? It'd just be interesting if they were strongly religious like that. That would be quite devastating as well, that knowledge that they haven't been able to find.
Well, I haven't got a religious bone in my body, but I would still feel I couldn't rest until I knew. So have a religious bone in your body, it'd probably be...
Well, particularly if you believe in certain rituals after death and you haven't been able to carry them out.
Brutal murder, like horrific way to be. I don't know, it just seems so sad because, yeah, they didn't have a lot of family connections here because they were both, you know, migrant, but people still love them and miss them.
But she's somewhere. Yeah. She's somewhere. Alone and, oh.
And it's just that male rage that can is so frightening.
Yeah.
You know, the rage of a male, whether or not they're big, small.
Yeah.
Kind of, what do they sometimes call it? The red mist comes down. You hear people talk about it and it's.
Yeah.
You think,
do you think it reminds me of that idea, though, of the superhuman strength of the mother, the yes. idea that a woman can lift a car off a child? Mm. Like, do you think that emotions can actually impact?
Lift you.
Yeah, to a point one way where, or the other.
Yeah. Yeah, probably.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose he's proof of it, isn't he?
Yeah. But no, he's never shown any remorse, ever.
Thank you for downloading Australian True Crime, and thank you to our team, which is one person, Bartholomew Heeran. If you enjoy the podcast, please take the time to leave us a nice review and 5 stars and to follow us on Facebook.